Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and this is the Friday Roundtable. We thought it might be a good week for a freewheeling discussion about politics. Congress is on a two-week break. Our representatives are in their districts to hear what constituents have to say. The Republican majority confirmed a U.S. Supreme Court nominee. Many support the president's strike on Syria, but they have no major legislative accomplishments to show for their first 3 months in office. Democrats are already scheming about how to take back the House in 2018. They're also strategizing about how to hang on to the governor's seat here in Minnesota next year and looking like it's going to be a crowded field of DFLers. And I'd like to hear from you via social media. Republican, DFLer, independent, if you were at a town hall meeting with your representative, what would you bend their ear about? So you show up at one of these town hall meetings with a member of Congress. What do you want to talk to them about? You can tweet me on that at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. Javier Murillo is with us. He's president of the local SEIU 26. Welcome back. Good to have you here.
Great to be here.
Annette Meeks is founder and CEO of the Freedom Foundation of Minnesota. Good to have you back, Annette.
Thanks for the invite. Happy to be here.
Larry Jacobs is here. He's chair for political studies at the University of Minnesota Humphrey School. Larry, good to see you again, and thanks for being here.
Great to be back.
Have I observed correctly that some of the members of Congress are not having as many town halls as they might have in other years? And is this because they're a little concerned about what's going to happen at the town hall? Annette, what do you think?
Well, it's nothing new. I hearken back. This is going to show how old I am. Back to 1986 during the Reagan recession and the farm crisis in Minnesota. And I was working for Minnesota's 2nd District Congressman Vin Weber. We had to stop having town hall meetings during that time because they got violent and they got very unhelpful. How's that? And so it was more helpful for us to help people who were in pretty dire straits at the time to have listening sessions and talk to them one-on-one rather than have this mob mentality that shows up and just screams everybody down. We got hung in effigy. It was quite
wow.
the time.
Yeah. Vin Weber was hung in effigy?
Oh, it was.
Oh my gosh.
I could go on and on. But there was a real dark side to it, too. There was some great pain and terrible things happening in the heartland. And when you represent, as he did at that time, 30 rural counties, you want to make sure you're listening to the problems and doing as much as you can to help people. We found town halls were not very helpful.
Okay. Javier and Larry, I hear Annette on the mob mentality that kind of feeds on itself. That said, I think it's pretty important to hear one another's voices in a forum. It might be hard on the person that's standing up at the front of the room, but isn't that important?
Oh, I just think that's what they sign up for. And, you know, we saw this in 2009. Democrats got a lot of heat from the Tea Party when there was a rebellion against the passage of the Affordable Care Act. And it's actually, you know, then the Republicans who benefited from that now are saying, well, you know, we need civility and we can't hold these. I think it's incredibly important. I think there's a big canard that's always thrown out about, oh, these are, you know, organized liberal groups, organized whatever, the same as in 2009, they were organized conservative groups. That's just what happens when, you know, when there's a policy or something that people disagree with, groups organize to attend events like this and be heard. And I think it's one of the things that people are not saying to explain the failure of the Trump care. But I think it was a big part of it was Republicans seeing an energized Democratic base come out. And there are a good number of seats that Hillary Clinton won, that the Republicans, congresspersons won the seat. And this alarms them. And it should.
You know, I think there used to be a time when you'd have quite a number of districts in Congress that were competitive, in which you'd have members needing to talk to their constituents, because if they're not building those lines of communication, they could well get voted out of office. We're in a totally different period of time. The competitiveness of districts have plummeted. It was probably about 40 or 50% when Annette Meeks was chief of staff to Newt Gingrich and working with Vin Weber back in the day. Today, it's about 16%. So most districts are locked up for one party or another. And the rules of the game are oriented around responding to the ideological orientation of that district. So going and doing a listening session or a town hall meeting, there's a bit of a fiction to it because it really isn't to hear from the whole district. The member, most of the time, four out of five cases, knows what their district wants, and they are not going to really be swayed by what they hear at a town hall meeting. It is simply for media consumption.
It's for media consumption. I mean, isn't it also significant, though, that even if you know what your district wants, you might be hearing a small percentage of people in the district who have a pretty valid or persuasive argument? And even if you're not going to change your mind, it's good to have that in mind. Is there something to that argument, Annette?
I think there's something to it, but so much of what Larry said really resonates with me that people have pretty much already made up their mind when they show up at these things. And that's part of the reason why they're not especially helpful. They already have a point of view, and they're there to scream it the loudest to make sure you hear it. And it's not just whether or not you have it, it's how well you can manage this mob mentality. And I talked to Congressman Emmer a couple weeks ago. We were on the same flight, and we were chatting back and forth, and he said, it's quite intimidating. And I'm thinking, you, Mr. Big Hockey Guy?
I know.
You're intimidated by this? And he said, really? Well, when you see people lined up down the street waiting to get into your town hall meeting.
Good.
Right. And he said, but I'll tell you what, you let them scream for a little bit, and then the rest of the audience shouted them down and said, hey, that's enough. We're here to talk about other issues other than
the constituent that
the small little group. And that I think that was very helpful. And Tom doesn't mind. He said he does.
He can
frequently
manage it. Right.
Yeah.
You see, I think I would disagree a little bit about whether it's useful and whether they are hearing anything useful to them. And I would point to the recent, you know, the special elections right now, the special election in Kansas, right? So this is a district that a Republican won, but more narrowly than anyone expected. It's a district that Congressman Pompeo, who they get to work with the administration, won by huge margins. And I think that's what it's that organized constituency, a base of Democrats that are upset, that should make Republicans very worried. And it's the reason that there are these string of special elections that are unexpectedly competitive.
I want to talk about Atlanta, Larry, but what do you want to say to Javier?
Well, I think he's absolutely right. But that's not the town hall meetings by a sitting member of Congress. This is something else. This is a special election. And Javier is absolutely right. It's a bit of a shocker. We don't know quite how important it is. Is it a outlier?
Or I mean, the Republican won by 9 points. I know that that's still quite a bit. Well, I know that's narrower than what they thought.
And the Republicans had to dump millions of dollars into it, into a safe seat.
$150,000 was not exactly millions of dollars. That's what the RNC put in.
But I think it was more than that.
But from an empirical political science perspective, what we look at is you kind of build a base. And the base here is presidential vote. Trump won by 27 points. The incumbent's re-election just 5 months ago won by 31 points.
This is in Kansas.
In the 4th district.
Right.
And here you've got Estes, who's the Republican who won, prevailed by 7. Now, this does not, in my view, stand out as significant yet. But we're going to be moving on. We've got special elections in Atlanta. We've got one in Montana. We just had one in California. Mm-hmm. And there are real reasons why Republicans, you know, candidly will say, there's some things here we have to track. This could be something. But we've also seen in the past where enthusiasm of Democrats who want to believe something's happening has proven not to be there. So,
Javier,
but I think the relationship between the town halls and this is it is about the energized base, right? That the Democratic Party did not spend any money in that race. The DCCC did not. The Congressional Campaign Committee did not spend any money in that race. Progressive websites did, and that's what generated the support and brought money in into the race. And I think that's what we're seeing right now, and that's what we see in the town halls is a very energized Democratic base. And an off-year election, that energizes bases.
But Larry's point is really good, isn't it? That is this just now, or is there something sustained here?
But yes, Annette. Part of it is what Larry said originally, which is we have pretty secure congressional districts throughout most of the United States. Mm-hmm. And I would say to my friends from Organizing America and every other liberal group that trotted down to Wichita, pick your battles and don't pick that one. You know, the only reason why they pick Wichita is it's a home to Koch Industries. And they thought, well, what a great poster child it would make if we could defeat the Republican challenger in the home territory of David Koch. They didn't. But more importantly, pick a race where you can win, not just where there's a high-profile target. And I think that's what's been happening.
Larry has an answer to that.
Well, I think, you know, you run in the special elections that come up. These are not, you know, kind of a wide pool. But I think the key question, Javier, and I'd be curious what you thought of this. Do you think the mobilization that we've seen, you know, the tens of thousands of people have showed up for marches and all sorts of other forms of Democrats, progressives, really being ready to go to the barricades, literally, against Donald Trump? Do you think that translates into votes in you know, more than a year from now? I think that's an open question.
I think that is an open question. I mean, I will say, as someone who is an advocate, an activist, after the election, I was so depressed. I didn't go to the Women's March on that day. I was traveling that day. And what it did for me, when I saw all these people who, some of whom I know, but know not to be active at all, they're sort of, you know, passive Democrats, and where, like, that what I felt was, oh, I see how we're going to take on Trump. Other people are going to step forward. And I am seeing that in dramatic numbers and real, like, organizationally. There's these Facebook groups of artists I see pop up, people having political potlucks every other week.
But and it's early days.
It's early days, but lucky for us, Donald Trump gives us something to be angry about pretty much every day.
We're going to talk about whether that's enough. Larry, what does that answer tell you?
I think we're all in agreement here. I think it's an open question, but I think, you know, you could play this both ways. It could be an outlier. It could be something that kind of fizzles over time. The Democrats are certainly capable of going after each other. If you're trying to put up a candidate, you know, tailor-made to a more conservative, you know, conservative-leaning district, what do you do with liberal activists who are, you know, really passionate? Then I think you look on the other side. You know, there are definitely some issues here of concern to Republicans. Donald Trump is the least popular president ever. You know, at least at this stage, very early, all sorts of caveats on that. But you see some despondency among Republicans and conservatives saying, wait a second, we just elected a Republican government and this is all you've done?
Yeah. I mean, we have to talk about Annette. I'm so glad you were free to do this today, because you really did not want Donald Trump elected. You felt a little more hopeful about it, I think, when we talked to you right after the election. Now, I don't know, what are we, 80-something days in or close? Mm-hmm. How are you feeling about him?
Well, if I do what I call my Trump inventory, he appointed yeah. some of the best people I could have ever imagined in some of the key positions matter to me.
One name that makes
Gorsuch,
you feel good.
Right off the bat.
Okay.
I have two friends who were law clerks for him. They have nothing but the finest and highest compliments for not only his legal mind, but also his judgment and his fairness. And so I look at somebody like that and think, wow, that was a pretty doggone good pick. And I've had many of my conservative brethren tell me, I'm glad I voted for Donald Trump, if nothing more than
really?
The Supreme Court.
Okay.
It means that much to us. That's a generational thing.
Your inventory, though,
yeah, well,
what else
then,
does it tell you?
Then you go through and you look at and say, okay, they're going through some awkward days. How's that? At the White House right now and in the administration.
Diplomatic.
Trying to be. That's pretty normal in any administration, especially in the first 100 days. You just have a lot of give and take. I think he made some early appointments inside his own team that now are coming to roost and
like
probably
Steve Bannon.
Yeah,
and
I don't
some
think
other.
He'll be around
yeah.
much longer.
As a president and as somebody who is governing, how do you feel about what he's done so far?
I think he has to figure out what he is about and what he wants to accomplish. And I think that part of it has been Congress has not been particularly helpful. Congress has been in a no mode for 8 years. no, we're not for that. No, we're not for Obamacare. No, we're not for this. And it's very difficult to go from being, you know, opposed to everything to, and here are our solutions and here's how we're going to pass them. That is a very different leadership style. And that is something they have to learn, and they have to learn it very quickly.
So it's really more about Congress than it is about the way he sees the job and himself.
Well, I don't think that Donald Trump came into this with the regular experience we anticipate with an a presidential hopeful coming into office. And once they're sworn in, we expect them to know the gig. He didn't know the gig. And he operates in a very, very different style, talking to friends who have been in meetings with him. He will go around the room and listen to everyone and then form his opinion after that. But he loves this. He loves the disagreement. He doesn't want three people that all agree with him to sit in the room with him. He wants that give and take. He wants to have that adversarial relationship, and that's very difficult.
I'm really startled to hear you say that, because he strikes me as somebody who doesn't want people to disagree with him. But okay, you guys, Javier and Larry, do you think?
I agree on 2 points. And that you said, you know, he needs to figure out what he's about. And I think the thing is, there's no new Donald Trump. This is what we've got. And what he's about is Donald Trump. And so I agree with you that Congress needs to would need to, if they're going to drive an agenda, it will have to be them, because Donald Trump, as we saw with Trump Care, that bill that Ryan put forward went against everything that Donald Trump said he would do when it came to health care. He said we'll have access for everyone, it'll be cheaper, it'll be better, and all of those were not accomplished by that bill. And that was sort of the failure there. And so, you know, now they're talking about tax reform. And again, I think that Congress will have to drive that. But I suspect that there is as little agreement about what to actually do on tax reform now that they actually have power, as little agreement on that as there was on health care.
Larry? Well,
so I imagine if you had a Jeb Bush or Marco Rubio as president, what would it look like? What would it look, and particularly what
less chaotic, probably?
Well, I think it's more profound. I mean, I would say there's a series, there's a network in both parties, and it varies quite a bit. There's
the spectrum of,
but there's a network, and it consists of really hundreds of people who are experts in different areas, and it's not experts who are out of touch with politics. They're very much tuned in to, different flavors. And if you had a Marco Rubio or Jeb Bush who had been elected instead of Donald Trump, you would not have had people like the initial National Security Advisor, Michael Flynn. You would never have had a Steve Bannon. This is insanity. And I'm speaking from the perspective of national security people who were simply floored by that kind of person, and it goes across the board. Secondly, I think some of the policy ideas are so far outside of the consensus between the Democrats and Republicans.
Exactly. Example.
Immigration being, I think, the best example. There is certainly, you know, tension between both parties, but there's also differences. George W. Bush was a big advocate for immigration reform. But what Donald Trump put forward was viewed by plenty of Republicans as hostile.
The travel ban and targeting
Muslim countries,
yep,
as contrary to our national security. And finally, Republicans have always, I think, had an advantage in thinking about the nuts and bolts of how you run a government. Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, both Bushes, really at a theory about how you set up a government, who you put into the government, and how you make sure you get control over that government. Donald Trump has put forward hardly anyone, and the people who have come up have often been nixed because they said something negative about Donald Trump during the campaign. And there's a lot. For instance, if you want to do tax reform,
yeah,
you look over in Treasury, they're missing their team.
I assume, Annette, that's what the voters want. And I'm not saying that the voters knew exactly what they wanted, but I assume in some ways they took a look at the way the traditional government works and didn't like it. And he's
I'm thinking out loud. I think
he's turned that upside down.
I think that it's very interesting. I was up north a couple weekends ago, and I found all of the Trump people that I talked to who were Trump prior to the election are even more Trump today. And the missteps, if you want to call them that, of this administration, they just kind of, that's what happens.
He's losing independence, right? He's not losing the core yet.
Well, I think that's what's going to be interesting in the next, 100 days, if you will. I think this is a guy, his lesson learned the hard way from this failed healthcare experiment is that this is not going to be passed as a hardcore Republican, very conservative bill. It's not. That was the mistake that President Obama made, where he passed it with just Democratic votes. This guy figured this out pretty quickly about a month ago, which is, I've got to reach across the aisle. And he has been spending a pretty fair amount of time courting more conservative Democrats.
This guy being Trump?
Yes,
figured that
President
out?
Trump. And I think that all of the biggest missteps that have occurred because of people like Steve Bannon, who have an ideology. You know, we're not revolutionary people. We don't elect a president because we think he's going to wage a revolution. We are incremental people, and we are, when all is said and done, we want somebody who gives some thoughtful analysis and they listen before they act. And instead, we had this bully that came out of nowhere who was appointed to a very significant post in the White House.
Bannon?
Yes.
Yeah.
And with
I don't
no
know if you were talking about Trump or Bannon, actually.
Right. I will ignore that comment. And, but I think that one of the things that Trump really campaigned heavily on, and there weren't a lot of ideas. It was more platitudes. But one thing he did say is, I will get the job done. He was the deal maker. And I think now there is a kind of a little change of face, which is let's do some deals and get this healthcare thing fixed.
You're listening to the Friday Roundtable. It's a conversation about politics. Javier Murillo with us from SEIU 26.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry about that. Annette Meeks is with us, founder and CEO of the Freedom Foundation of Minnesota, and Larry Jacobs is with us here from the Humphrey School. Can we talk about healthcare for a minute? Because you said some interesting things there, Annette. I want to play something that Republicans and Speaker Ryan have been saying for a long time, and I'm going to test it against the facts with Larry because he studies healthcare policy. Let's listen.
Obamacare is collapsing under its own weight right now. Plans are pulling out right now. Obamacare, to quote an insurance head of an insurance company, is in a death spiral.
Is that true?
Well, let me quote the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, whose director was appointed by Republican leaders. And they came out with a report about the Ryan proposal initially, and they provide pretty convincing evidence that there has been challenges, but that the state exchanges are largely working, that there was an increase in premiums as the exchanges and the health plans are trying to get started. But for the most part, it looks to be stabilizing. There are exceptions. Minnesota is one of them. And there are some very particular reasons about health plans that came in and undercut the price point, and now there's been a response.
Couldn't deliver the care for the price they said they could.
Exactly.
Right?
But I think in general, you know, if the exchanges are given more time and they're provided, responsible leadership, they will prevail. But let me be very clear. I don't think the exchanges are really the test of Obamacare.
Right.
The Medicaid program is really the big government program, and that's done great.
By the way, more Republican governors are signing on to expanding Medicaid.
Right.
And then you've got the insurance exchanges, and you can see members of Congress in the House, Republicans, who are just like strangling themselves trying to figure out how they undo these. Then you've got the benefits to seniors to fill in what was known as a donut hole in the prescription drug benefit that George W. Bush passed,
right,
and on and on down. So the focusing on the exchanges, it's significant, but it is not Obamacare. It's a component.
Javier than Annette.
I think that this whole talk about the death spiral, which is not borne out by the Congressional Budget Office numbers at all, and I think in that that section we just listened to, I think the CEO that he's quoting is that the Aetna CEO, and Aetna was also found by a federal judge to have lied about their reason for leaving the Obamacare exchanges, that they found that despite their attempts to conceal this information from the court, that what they were actually doing was reacting to a federal antitrust lawsuit that was keeping them from taking part in this merger. And it gets to the perversity in our healthcare system, that the problems that people are facing, right, that these healthcare executives that are saying this is a death spiral are making out like bandits. The insurance companies, they're not running out. They're not going out of business. They are doing really, really well. And we have a system that rewards these middle people. And it is a perverse system, I think. But Obamacare, like, preserved the health insurance companies.
Exactly.
It was health insurance reform.
No wonder they were on board.
Right,
throwing
exactly.
the hospitals,
that's,
too.
That's right. And so what we have now, right, is people who are making out like bandits, saying it's in a death spiral when the numbers belie that.
I think there's plenty of blame to go around. I would throw in the hospitals as well, who were at the trough of Obamacare when all of the goodies were handed out back in 2010. They've all done quite well. Who hasn't done well are the average consumers out there who, unless they're covered by a nationwide ERISA policy, are like the rest of us out there. And we are the ones in a death spiral.
Seeing the premiums go up, you mean?
Oh, my gosh. I went from paying about $460 now to I'm close to $900 on the
individual
market.
Yeah,
on the individual market. It is my largest single expense. It even surpassed my mortgage 2 years ago. But let me tell you where I think we have some thoughtful work that needs to be done. And I would guess at the end of the day, they will pass something. I know they will. Congress and that the president will sign. And I think it needs to start with looking at some of the biggest problems we have, which is we're throwing boatloads of money at Medicaid expansion, for example. I'll use this as a good example, because we want to make sure the poorest of the poor do have access to, remember, this is not health care. This is health insurance.
Right.
And we often equate the two as one and the same, and they're not. One of the biggest problems we've had with Medicaid expansion is it helping improve people's health? And the summation from some of the biggest studies that have been done, I'll point to Oregon, is it hasn't. They're still utilizing ER visits. They're still finding there's doctors who will not accept assignment. They will not accept Medicaid as a payment. That is a huge problem when it comes to greater Minnesota.
But Annette, let me ask you this. If you live in Texas, where they have not expanded Medicaid, and you don't have health insurance, are you better off if the governor would decide to expand Medicaid, even if the quality of the care and a lot of these other metrics is not where it should be?
Or not if
or
you can't
are you
find
better
a
off
doctor.
If you don't?
But
you're
actually,
better off if you have no health insurance.
Well, no, I mean,
it's like
you're
that.
About the same is what I'm
really?
Trying to. Let me give you a great example. There was a great article in the Star Tribune about 3 months ago that highlights one of the biggest problems with Medicaid, which is doctors who are unwilling to accept Medicaid as a payment. And the reason they do this is there's a multitude, but more importantly, dentists are a good example. If it costs $80 for an extraction, Medicaid will, or whatever our state program here is, will pay $25. That dentist then makes a very dollar-based decision, which is it's not worth my time
right.
to take $25 for a procedure that I have to charge $80 with my administration and everything else, my insurance. So they don't accept assignment. They don't accept those patients. And those people still go without care and ultimately end up in the ER, which increases all of our costs.
Larry?
So Annette's raised some important issues and issues that we've heard discussed. And I'm saddened to hear about her personal experience with
how expensive
her,
it is?
Well, with her premiums. But I think rather than reasoning from anecdote, if you look at the data, again, nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, what they report is that the subsidies and the assistance for deductibles for middle and lower income people has actually helped about 2/3 of those on insurance of the Obamacare exchanges. So that's important. Secondly, on the issue about Medicaid in states that do not have Medicaid, there's been very persuasive, rigorous research that shows how much people would be helped. In Texas, thousands of people are dying because they don't have access to basic care. And this is not really a matter of dispute. This is studies. There's one that came out about a year ago from the Harvard School of Public Health. You can look it up. It's been peer-reviewed. There have been a number of other studies showing the implications of states that do not expand Medicaid for real living people and their quality of life and, in fact, whether they live or not.
You want to respond to that?
I would actually say I probably agree with 80% of what you said. we equate health insurance. Just because you have health insurance, I speak to a lot of my friends who are also on the open market like I am. They have health insurance that they can't afford to use because their deductible, for example, I have a $6,500 deductible. I will never meet that, God willing, unless I have surgery or some major illness.
But you still have the safety net of some kind of insurance.
I would rather have basic insurance then.
Would you rather have no insurance? Because that is the case, which is where we started here.
But that's what I think we need to allow the states. Rather than this one-size-fits-all Washington prescription, let's let the states experiment.
Does that make sense?
Let's let the states figure it out. There's a different need in where you have vast swatches of rural areas and poor people in Texas than there is in states like Minnesota.
Javier, does that make sense?
Well, if I'm understanding correctly, that the problem with offering basic health plans or these sort of cafeteria plans is that you have the adverse selection issue, right? That healthier people will choose cheaper plans. And that is the problem that Obamacare is trying to solve by creating bigger pools, is to put healthier people in pools where they are paying. And so it ends up making the system more expensive. We end up with the same problem of, a healthy person in their 20s, either not having health insurance or buying a very cheap plan. That person gets in a horrible car accident, they're in the ER, and they can't pay their bills. We're back in the same place we started from.
Larry?
I think Annette's case for a slimmer plan and allowing more choice is compelling, and I probably going to move in that direction if Congress is able to do anything. But let's just be clear about the consequences. What Obamacare did was it said there are certain basic essential services that everybody should have access to. And we could talk about those. Should every American have access to maternity care? What about mental health care? And on down the list. And people can disagree about that, but if you don't put it into law, what you see is the health plans competing on what they leave out. And that's what we've had. I mean, this is not like an imagined risk. This is what we had before 2010. I think a lot of people, they actually know that the choice is, should all women have access to maternity care if they need it?
You're listening to the Friday Roundtable. It's a conversation about politics. Larry Jacobs, Javier Murillo, and Annette Meeks in the studio. We've got to get a look at the latest news, and then we'll continue our conversation.
Good morning. I'm Phil Picardi in the NPR newsroom. The Trump administration is dropping a lawsuit against North Carolina after the state moved to undo its bathroom bill. Justice Department lawyers filed a motion today to dismiss a federal lawsuit. The move does not directly affect separate pending litigation by LGBT rights advocates who say the new North Carolina law does not go far enough to ensure rights for all. North Carolina's compromise deal last month got rid of the most well-known provision of House Bill 2 that required transgender people to use restrooms corresponding to the sex on their birth certificates. North Korea's vice foreign minister is warning his country is ready to launch a preemptive strike if the U.S. shows any sign of military aggression. The minister told the Associated Press President Trump's tweets are adding fuel to a vicious cycle of tensions on the Korean Peninsula. He did not rule out the possibility of a new nuclear test in the near future, despite reports that Washington is considering military action if the North goes ahead with it. Afghan officials say 36 fighters with the Islamic State group were killed in a U.S. attack on a Tuttle complex in a remote eastern part of the country near the Pakistan border yesterday. The bomb dropped Thursday was the largest non-nuclear weapon ever used in combat by the U.S. military. Afghan officials say there were no civilian casualties. And Russia, Syria, and Iran have strongly warned the U.S. against launching new strikes in Syria. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, who hosted his Iranian and Syrian counterparts at today's trilateral meeting in Moscow, denounced last week's U.S. attack on Syria and warned any further such action would entail grave consequences for global security. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:40.
Support comes from Hamline University. Advance your career with graduate offerings in business, creative writing, public administration, nonprofit management, or a wide array of programs for educators. Visit hamline.edu/learn.
I'm Carrie Miller, and you're listening to the Friday Roundtable. It's a conversation about politics. Annette Meeks is here from the Freedom Foundation of Minnesota. Larry Jacobs is here from the Humphrey School at the U of M. And Javier Murillo is here from local SEIU 26. Larry, I caught a bit of the conversation that you had this week with political scientist Catherine Kramer. She was over at the Humphrey School. She has written a book about research that she did in rural Wisconsin, and she's making some conclusions perhaps about rural voters. What was the takeaway for the conversation from you? And then we'll hear a little bit of what she said.
You know, a lot of us are wondering what in the world's going on in rural America. Republicans are very pleased. In Minnesota, for instance, Hillary Clinton only won 9 counties. And you kind of look at the vote count.
Wow.
And there are whole lots of parts of the state that have been longtime Democratic areas that are now being won by Republicans. That's matched up with what's been happening in the House. Why is that happening? And Kathy Kramer goes in. It's not based on exit polls or a lot of the data, frankly, that my type of people count. She went all over the state of Wisconsin. She sat down with people and listened to them talk. And her conclusion is this is really about identity. People in rural areas see themselves as part of a group. And for that group, they are quite hostile to urban areas because they don't feel like they're respected. They don't feel like they get their fair share of resources from government. And they feel that they are actually being targeted in unfair ways.
Here's what she said. I think you asked her about this sense of grievance and injustice.
You know, I didn't often find people calling themselves rural residents. You know, they wouldn't use that phrase. And oftentimes they're talking about themselves as rural people by saying things like people around here or people like us, or even gesturing like geographically, just, you know, to where they live. But the part that is so politically important is the injustice part of it, meaning people sense that it's not just I identify as a small town person, but people like me in places like this are not getting our fair share.
Annette, you're probably pretty familiar with that perception from as long as you've been in Minnesota politics.
That is that's a powerful statement she just made there. I've been like Larry and I were talking before the show, immersed in some of the great reading that is out there on this topic from White Trash. I don't know if you've read any of these books, but here are people who've had their groundwater polluted. Their groundwater is absolutely unusable. And yet, rather than blame the corporation, they tend to look outside and say, well, it's Washington's fault. Why the heck won't they fix this? And that's part of the problem, is this waiting for Superman learned helplessness that they talk about in both Hillbilly Elegy and otherwise, that we've ignored the problems and the grievances in some of these areas for so long and allowed them to fall further and further behind the 7-county metro area, the 13-county greater metro area here, that they no longer feel like anyone hears them. They no longer feel like they have any identity other than us people. And I do see the injustice in their minds, and whether perceived or not, it's a very real problem that we have to deal with. And I see the hopelessness as well. That is quite the serious problem.
So I've been thinking about this quite a lot, and particularly because I think that Democrats, there's a conversation happening in the Democratic Party that I think then breaks down into like, well, should we talk about class or race? And I find that very frustrating because I think that there's a deep sense of grief in rural America. There's loss. There are towns that are losing population, people seeing their kids not being able to stay or not wanting to stay in their towns. And there's a lot of grief and loss in the opioid crisis and such. What some politicians have done is to effectively convince people that people in urban areas are the reason why that is happening. And I think the challenge for Democrats, I think when we say, yes, that the 7-county metro area is doing well, not people of color, and, you know, not the African-American community, where unemployment is much higher and poverty is increasing. And so we need to do, progressives need to do a better job of finding this, the connection between those two areas of grief and loss and pain, and tell a story that of connection rather than one of division. That is our big challenge. It is difficult, but we absolutely must do it. And I'd say that for progressives, but as a society, you know, we can't just turn around and have urban people blame rural people for our problems. I mean, that there is so much pain in different communities, and they are deeply connected in the way you just talked about, Annette, right? The water pollution in Flint and water pollution in the South, driven by demands of corporations, and these things should be talked about as connected.
Larry?
You know, I think one of the challenges for our politics in America, and I would say particularly in the Democratic side, is a tendency towards thinking about issues and transactional relationships. So it wasn't uncommon for Hillary Clinton to give a speech saying, here are the issues I stand for. And then she would often connect them to different groups of voters. And I think what Kathy Kramer's research demonstrates convincingly to me is it's not really about issues. It's about social identity. And so when I pressed her, Kathy said she thought there was a good chance that Donald Trump would be evaluated based on his identification with rural people and other groups of Americans, not on whether he delivers on his promises and whether he performs to expand job growth. That's a kind of a, it flips our whole idea of politics on its head because of our tendency to think of it in quite transactional terms.
But I mean, doesn't emotion, eventually he has to deliver on job growth, which is the visible fulfillment of the promise in some of these towns,
right? Do you think
right?
people who are Trump supporters in rural areas are going to be turning on Donald Trump because, you know, the millions of jobs he talked about don't arrive? I actually don't think that's going to happen. I think there'll
because they already believe that the jobs aren't coming back.
Either that
as much as they want
there'll be other scapegoats on why that this didn't happen.
I see.
I think this issue of identity is something we have to wrestle with. It's not just identity in urban areas. Mm-hmm. It's an identity of America and Americans. Barack Obama was very good at articulating that. I think Ronald Reagan was very effective in articulating that. Somehow the Democrats have kind of fallen off this election cycle on that front.
What do you think, Annette?
I agree wholeheartedly, especially with the Hillary Clinton. It's not about what you can promise them. It's giving them hope that things will be different. And I think one of the things that I see happening right here in our state legislature that I think is actually quite significant, and in talking with folks, especially in rural Ohio, that little Appalachian area there, is we have gotten into an education system that says every child's going to go to college, and if you don't, our system isn't really geared towards you. And you're seeing a new focus, especially with this legislative session, on vocational training and offering different alternatives for kids. Right now, we have PSEO, the post-secondary mm-hmm. enrollment option for kids who can take their junior and senior years and get college credit. What if we expanded that to vocational schools and allowed them to get that training so that by the time they get that high school diploma, which hopefully they will stick around and do this. And Javier, this is, I think, another really important urban initiative to make sure every kid graduates with a diploma they can read and one that's meaningful to them. And that might be vocational, technical education, whatever it is. But this is, we have a great demand for these jobs and the training that's not happening right now in many rural areas. And this is kind of a nice compromise to figure out what's the demand, how can we fill it. Let's not focus on seat time. We saw it this week with Governor Scott Walker in Wisconsin saying, let's not focus on seat time. Let's focus on what we and how we give them a good education that's meaningful.
I know what the arguments to this are, Javier.
Well, I was thinking on the Trump support and what will turn people or will it turn people. And there's a number I saw this week that shook me to our core, the ABC poll about Republican opinion on the strikes in Syria.
Mm-hmm.
And it was 86% approval. And when Obama was contemplating strikes under Syria under similar circumstances, that number was 22%.
Republicans
approved of that. Of Republicans, right. For Democrats, under Obama, it was 38% approval. And under Trump, it's 37% approval.
Hmm.
So it's actually not a... You know, there's a lot of two-siderism that happens in the media. Both sides do this.
Yes.
In this instance, what we have is, I think, a scary blind allegiance that is driving opinions. And I think this is the stuff of authoritarianism. This is the stuff of, like, when I hear, you know, you say, Larry, that it's not going to be the jobs that convince people. I'm not sure I disagree with you. And it is scary. Because I think what that tells me is that the driver of identity, I agree with you what you're saying on identity. And when Democrats say that this last election is the end of identity politics, it's more conservative Democrats. What they mean is stop talking about people of color, because identity politics did great in this last election. White identity was front and center, and that's what they pushed. And so that's the vacuum that has been filled. And now we have a part. It just seems like zombie numbers.
So I agree with Javier about his concern with regard to the situationalism of Americans. If it's a Republican president, if you're a Democrat, it's got to be terrible. If you're a Republican with a Republican president, it's got to be great.
Except that number showed that Democrats were just as critical, basically, when Obama was considering, right, or just as supportive when he was considering Syrian strikes.
Yeah, I think the issue here is partisanship, though. I think the issue is that we've got a partisan mindset that's locked in. What concerns me about Syria is I think we're seeing a setting up of two presidencies with a newcomer into the White House. And it's kind of like a stimulus response situation. Donald Trump was having root canal when he was trying to pass the repeal of Obamacare through Congress. There was practically no one who agreed with him. He's got a lot of criticism of Republicans. No Democrat was going to support him. He bombs Syria. And the leadership in both parties is like, attaboy.
Yeah.
There's some discordant notes among some about, well, we should be talking about this. It should be, kind of both branches of government. But that's typical. And what we've seen in the last 30 years is presidents get away all the time with going it alone, with military strikes, national security more broadly, and even diplomatic policy. So that's what's concerning me is that Donald Trump is now being kind of trained to take adventurous steps on bombing.
I've really wondered about this because this has probably felt pretty good, Annette, to Donald Trump. This may have been one of the more positive weeks of an early presidency because he hasn't had all this roiling in Congress, and mostly he's had approval from his own party. I mean, doesn't this feel pretty good for a president who pulls off something like this?
I think for him, any victory was significant, and last week was his best week ever. That's not saying much. That bar is pretty low. He had approval of his first Supreme Court justice with three Democrats supporting him.
Mm-hmm.
And he also had the overwhelming support of Syria, the bombing, the targeted strikes that occurred there. But that all came with a caveat, which is, now, if you're going to do anything more, we want Congress. We want to talk about it. You can't just keep doing this unilaterally on your own.
Yep.
That's our job.
But do you believe they'll do that? I don't think. I mean, I think
I absolutely believe.
I think this has been a bipartisan failure of decades. That for Congress, it is safer for
right.
the president to act, and then they wait to see how it went, and then they put out a press release to say whether they agreed or not. That is safer than to actually follow the separation of powers in this instance. And I think that, absolutely.
Right.
I do think that what in this instance will come home to roost not that very soon is that there's no coherent policy.
Right.
There's no coherent, it was not that long ago that Donald Trump was praising Assad. It was not that long ago when he was saying last week they were saying, well, it's not about regime change. And now suddenly this week, he is worse than Hitler, according to Sean Spicer. So what is the policy?
Well, just because he needs a remedial class in world history,
Spicer.
I think there is a significant national security threat here, though. A lot of our relationships with other countries, either allies or rivals, relies on perceptions about what a president will do. And Donald Trump has sent so many messages.
Yeah.
The likelihood of misperception, whether it's are we about to bomb North Korea?
Right.
In which case, does North Korea launch a preemptive strike? Or are relationships, you know, in Europe, where we've said both the NATO alliance should stand on its own, and now we're saying it's very important, I'm behind it.
Larry, you know what makes me cringe about this is there are analysts who say, and that's great, because he keeps all these other countries like North Korea on pins and needles. He's unpredictable. He might be as crazy as they are.
Who's saying?
I mean, you actually hear analysts saying there's advantage in being unpredictable.
Yeah, this is known as the – Richard Nixon referred to this as the bad man theory.
Uh-huh.
But what you see if you look at careful analysis is that some of the worst moments in U.S. foreign policy and in the foreign policy of other countries has come from misperceptions, miscalculations, mm-hmm. because of uncertainty about what a country will do. And right now, honestly, if you were to lay out a series of scenarios, I wouldn't have a clue as to how Donald Trump will respond. It seems so random.
What do you think the next – we're almost at the end of the roundtable here. What ends up dominating the next 100 days? Annette, what do you think?
I think Donald Trump is going to have a reset, and I think it's going – he needs a victory. He needs a policy victory. And so I think one of the biggest mistakes they made was taking on health care. That took President Obama 2 years, and it never achieved a Republican or a bipartisan majority or bipartisan vote. I think what Donald Trump is going to do is probably look at jobs creation and a stimulus package and go to something like that, then work their way once they have a bipartisan compromise on health care. But he needs a victory.
Javier?
Do you say once they have a bipartisan compromise on health care?
So, I think they will.
I don't think they will because there's no, you know, you have the Freedom Caucus and then the they won't accept things, or the moderates won't the things that need to actually be done to improve Obamacare, I don't think will happen. I think the things that, you know, will dominate the next 100 days will be personnel changes. I think this drama between Steve Bannon and the, you know, it's now become sort of almost edible, the drama in the White House. So, you know, Kushner will end up surviving. And so it'll be dominated by those kinds of things. You know, when the president tweets about Korea, I am scared, because when he sees himself being praised for bombing Syria,
right,
like, well, apparently bombing might improve my numbers.
Larry,
it doesn't seem to have done that.
Next 100.
Well, you know, I actually agree with or share the concerns of both Annette and Javier. ACA is a requirement for the Trump administration.
Affordable Care Act.
Right. They need the money, the $1 billion that they were going to pull out of it in the Ryan plan, mm-hmm. to help make tax cuts possible.
Uh-huh.
And so there's a linkage there. The risk, though, as Javier said, is that there is no way to pass this. And remember, the battle we've just gone through in the House, that was the easy part. Because then you get to the Senate, and the Senate is going to be much more moderate, and then it's going to have to come back. Anyway, there's a lot more to this story. The problem then is that Donald Trump ends up beaching the first part of his presidency on the shoals of congressional intransigence. And so I'm not really expecting a whole lot different in the second 100 days. I think we're going to see – it's going to be a little bit of a groundhog day. Certain different personalities, but another try at Affordable Care Act that won't go anywhere. Perhaps some more adventuresome policy efforts in terms of national security and foreign policy. But I'm not expecting a kind of like a Nirvana moment.
My God. No Nirvana for the next 100 days. We all have agreement on that?
Yeah. I think that's right.
Good to have you here. Thank you very much.